So good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. It's so beautiful to be with this community once again, this international Sangha through Sangha Live. And I want to take a moment to say hello to our friends that are coming in from all over California and Lagos, Nigeria, from Copenhagen, from the UK, from Costa Rica, from West Virginia. I'm from East Virginia, or just regular Virginia. Folks from Maryland, from Charlottesville, where my parents are living, Newcastle in the UK, Seattle. So wonderful to be with so many of you all today from all over the world. I just have such gratitude for being with you all today on this beautiful and overcast sort of balmy day here on the East Coast of the US. My name is Booker. My pronouns are she and her. And I live in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, which is the unceded territory of the Lenape people. And I acknowledge the land of the ancestral people who inhabited this land to remind us what happens when greed, hatred, and delusion kind of take over. What happens is this destruction and a tearing apart of history, of lineage. So I just want to honor those people who stewarded this land so beautifully and just remind me to care for this land as much as I can. And I also want to bring in my ancestors of liberation. So those are folks like Audre Lorde, who self-describes herself as writer, mother, poet, warrior, someone whose writings have been so influential in my life around her fierceness, around self-care and self-preservation. I want to bring in my ancestors of liberation, Malcolm X, who spoke of doing things, whatever it took, by all means necessary. And I feel that in my quest for liberation, for collective liberation, that it really looks like whatever it takes for all of us to get there together. It's a huge inspiration. And of course, I want to invite in Thich Nhat Hanh, who is a recent ancestor for many of us, the Vietnamese monk activist. He was exiled from his homeland during the Vietnam War and just really such an influence around staying in our practice, no matter what atrocities are around us. And I also want to invite in an ancestor of my lineage, the Insight lineage. And specifically, I want to bring in Nani Bala Barua, who is known to most of us as Dipa Ma. And Dipa Ma, if you don't know of her, was a woman who lived in Bangladesh in the 20th century, who had a lot of great loss in her life and was close to dying of a broken heart when she was advised to practice meditation. And it was very rare for a householder, a woman to practice and to be a great teacher to folks like Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield. And she really knew that you could find liberation in everyday life. And so she really encouraged other women to be on this journey, to be on this path, to not flee and go to a cave, but to stay in this practice of liberation in your day-to-day task. And so she's been a huge inspiration to me and my teachers and how I live my practice. And I also want to acknowledge the heartache of the world that we're living in right now, the ongoing pandemic, the destruction of the earth, dictatorships that are on the rise around the world. And these ongoing wars that are breaking our hearts and reminding us how deeply our lives are intertwined. And so taking a moment to pause and perhaps reflect on why we are on this path, why we continue to practice. Perhaps it's to clear the dust out of our eyes, to connect our hearts and remind us that we belong to each other. So let's just take a moment to gather our hearts and minds in this collective space to bring in our intention for our practice today. And so today, as Faith mentioned, I will be speaking about the first two of the paramis, generosity and morality, and how these practices are a movement towards a shared world. These are the first two of the 10 paramis, this roadmap of the journey that the Brahmin Sumedha took to be born over and over and over again until finally he was born into the body of Siddhartha Gautama, who would become the Buddha. And it gives us an understanding of not just what the Buddha said, but what he did to attain these 10 qualities of heart and mind, collectively known as the paramis. All the mistakes and the lessons learned along the way for him to become the one who would wake up, and how we can explore how these practices can really support us in our lives today. And so we'll begin by having a formal meditation practice. So I invite you to take any of the four classic postures. So if the body is feeling sleepy or restless, you might want to try a standing posture today. If you've been holding a lot and you feel like you've got the weight of the world on your shoulders, you might want to rest on the earth and allow Mother Earth to hold you. And if you're sitting upright, either on a cushion or a chair, I like to kind of tuck my chin in and lift my head up to bring a sense of expansion and length to my spine. And so if you're standing, you want to keep the knees soft and bring some weight to your pelvic bone. If you're lying down, I like to keep my knees bent, again with my feet rooted into the earth, so I can feel the back of my sacrum, that triangle bone at the base of my spine, really root down to the earth. And if you're sitting on a cushion, on your bed, on a chair, to make sure that your hips are a little bit higher than your knees, to have your feet under your knees in front of your ankles, to create a sense of ground and foundation underneath you. And if it feels right for you this morning, you can hold the eyes softly open, perhaps staring at a place on the wall in front of you. You can look down to the tip of your nose or rest your eyes all together. So everything we need to be known can be found through the felt sense of the body and the quality of the breath as it responds. And so we'll take a moment, going back to this foundational practice of knowing breath and body. And so feeling into where there is contact between this body on the earth, starting with our foundation, perhaps lifting the toes, spreading them wide, and then gently, and one by one, feeling the toes land back onto the earth. Rising on the balls of the feet, lifting the heels up. Energetically spreading the heels and then feeling them place themselves back onto the earth. And so you can do this in a standing posture or also in the lying down posture if your feet are on the earth. And just feeling where there is contact between these feet and the earth. Some of you might take in the fourth posture of walking meditation. And if that's what you're choosing today, feeling when there is contact between earth and foot and noticing when there is this lifting and that space in between. Seeing if you can find those four corners of the bottoms of your feet and feeling some roots beginning to connect you to the earth. And bringing your awareness up to your ankles and feeling into that space between the ankles and the kneecaps. Perhaps flexing those calf muscles to know where your lower legs are in space. Noticing the rounding of the knees. And bringing awareness to the space between the kneecaps and the hip joints. And then feeling into the pelvic bone, the heavy bone that sits in the center of our body, connecting the bottom to the tops of our bodies. If you're sitting upright, you might be more aware of the sits bones that are at the bottom of our pelvic bone, of our pelvic bone. Perhaps we want to rock from side to side, maybe from front to back. And see if we can feel ourselves coming back to the presence of this body, of finding the center. We're not leaning too much towards the future or leaning too much into the narrative of the past, but can we bring the body into the present moment? If you're lying down, you might be aware of the back of the pelvic bone, which is the sacrum, that triangle bone, that flat bone. And as you rest the body on the earth, you might feel the flatness of that bone creating a sense of connection and ground to this body on the earth. And if you're standing, you might feel the heaviness of that bone. So again, if you're standing, we're standing with feet that are rooted down, knees that are soft. Feeling the solidity of that pelvic bone, again, rooting you down, grounding you down, while lifting the top of you to grow out of the stillness of that pelvic bone. Perhaps as you breathe in, you can feel the expansion of breath reach across the collarbones to the tips of your shoulders. And as you breathe the breath out, can you feel the breath bringing weight to your elbows, gently pulling the shoulders away from the ears? And if you're standing or walking, perhaps that out breath brings weight to the tips of your fingers, bringing some space through the heart center. giving some space in the neck if the neck's been feeling crunched. So feeling some length in there. Resting the tongue on the bottom of the mouth, allowing the jaw to unhinge, the teeth to unclench. Feeling the softness of the cheeks, the stillness of the eyes, whether the eyes are open or looking down or closed altogether. Feeling the softness across the eyebrows, the forehead. And perhaps in the stillness, we can begin to feel an expansion and contraction or rising and falling as the breath is known as it moves through the body as wind element. If you're coming into today with a little bit of anxiety or energy, you might want to rest the breath down into the low belly. And so perhaps resting the hands over top of the belly, and as you breathe in, feeling the belly expand under the fingers. And as you breathe the breath out, feeling the belly reaching back towards the spine. And so breathing in, feeling the expansion of the belly. And as you breathe the breath out, feeling the belly button reaching back towards the spine. I also sometimes like to rest one hand inside the other and perhaps feeling the breath through the palms of my hands or the breath through the bottoms of my feet. Getting curious about the beginning of the breath through the nostrils as cool breath breathes itself in. And at the top of that breath, there's a pause where the breath sort of swirls around and then breathes itself back out into a warm breath that might tickle the top of your lip. Feeling the fullness of that out breath, that pause. And then as you breathe that breath back in, how that breath turns cool again. And so play around, explore where you can know the movement, the rhythm of breath in this body, how breath expresses itself through your body. And you might begin to get a sense of what brings this body to a place of homeostasis, a place of refuge, of rest, a place that you can come back to when the mind begins to wander. It could be the sense of stillness as any part of the body that is connecting to earth. That could be the anchor wherever there's a sense of contact between body and earth. It could be staying with the curiosity of movement of breath, the rhythm of the breath in the body. We can also fall back on the anchor of our sense doors. So maybe it's the tightness, the compression, the comfort of a fuzzy sock around the foot, or a the weight of a blanket resting on the lap. I sometimes like to have the tassels of a blanket and sort of feel them in between my fingers as a place for me to come back to that sense of touch. It could be opening up the sense door of sound, noticing sound that is near, sound that is far away. Coming back to the taste of a meal or the bitterness of coffee or tea that might be lingering. So we're using body as our anchor, whether it's through the touch point, the stillness of body, the movement of breath, opening up the sense doors of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touch as a place where we can land, come back to our touch point. When the mind begins to wander, when the heart begins to feel overwhelmed. So where do we come back to? What is it that can allow us to soften the edges? What is it that can allow us to lay down the burdens of our day, our week, our month? So what can we lay down? And how can we offer a sense of ease and rest, spaciousness in this body, this heart, this mind? Thank you so much for your practice. And I would like to welcome in our friend from Finland who just said that they've snuck in. They've gotten a seat at the back of the hall. So I appreciate you all arriving and being here. I have historically and presently found it really difficult to have a daily formal meditation practice on my own. And over these last 2 years, I'm increasingly not alone in this camp. Not because folks don't want to practice or have stopped seeing the benefit of practice, but because sometimes closing our eyes and going inwards simply isn't the right medicine. And so my primary practice has been studying, speaking to Kalyan and Mita, my spiritual friends, listening deeply, and taking my practice sort of off the cushion and into my daily life. And this has looked like working with these practices of the Paramis, this practice of knowing generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolve, metta, and equanimity. These practices that allow me to stay in deeper connection to myself and to the global world. And these practices have really been life-giving these last 2 years when there has been such a sense of isolation, loneliness. It's really allowed me to stay connected to my heart and to remember that I'm not alone. And so today we'll start at the beginning of these 10 paramis, these 10 attainments of cultivating these qualities of heart and mind. And so we'll start with generosity. The Pali word is dana, and virtue or morality, and the Pali word for that is sila. And so with these first two paramis, we're moving towards undoing the stress of our egocentric lives to bring the welfare of ourselves, bring the welfare of others into our hearts and minds, that we're not just living so myopically, only thinking of ourselves. And so if it feels appropriate and good for your body to remain in the posture, whatever posture you took for meditation, you can do that. Or you can also sit upright and open your eyes and bring your awareness to a talk in that way. So I invite you to allow your body to be any way that allows you to listen with an open heart and open mind. So we'll begin with generosity. When I began my practice, I, like many folks, was in a really transitional stage in my life. And I was looking for a place to land. I wasn't necessarily seeking, but I just wanted to land, to feel a sense of stillness in my life. I had moved to New York City in the late 90s to work in the fashion industry, which I did for a long time. And about 5 or 6 years into it, I was really looking for a way to get out. And part of my exploration to figure out what to do next landed me at New York Insight. And when I first started my meditation practice, I didn't understand the teachings of the Dharma. It was like, blah, blah, blah. I didn't understand it. But I loved the way that I felt afterwards. I love the warmth of the people of the Sangha. The felt sense of my body being at ease and still. And my teacher, Dina Sharp, always saying, Don't worry about getting it. Just allow the Dharma to wash over you. And one of the first teachings that I thought that I got was that of Dana, of generosity. I was like, I got this one. You come in, you hear a talk, you put some cash in the box at the back of the room. It appeared very straightforward, very transactional, which made absolute and total sense to me at that stage of my life. And a few years into my practice, it was time for me to sit my first retreat. And I could not understand how I could afford it. It seemed so expensive, like all the money in the world. And it felt like such an indulgence. And who was I to, you know, allow myself that kind of indulgence, to have that kind of space to just be with my practice? It just felt, I couldn't wrap my head around how I could do that. It seemed like to do that came from such a place of privilege, and I didn't see myself as one who had any privilege at that time. And Gina let me know that I could apply for a scholarship or apply to be a work retreatant. And I come from a very proud, hardworking family of origin, and so asking for a scholarship was something completely out of my comfort zone. And asking to be a work retreatant brought up a lot for me, you know, being the descendant of enslaved Africans and knowing how hard my grandmother had worked as a domestic worker for most of her life. I didn't want to work. And so I began to feel this tightness in my body, this shutting down around the idea. And Gina asked me to begin a practice of saying yes to acts of generosity, saying yes to anything anyone offered me for a year. And which I did not understand at all as a spiritual practice. I didn't know what saying yes, how that could deepen my spiritual practice at all. And so through this practice, this process, I began to understand that there was this reciprocity in the practice of Dana. The act of giving is a movement towards a shared world, a shared experience. So when I said no, because of my pride and ego, no to my parents helping me pay my rent, no to a friend treating me to a meal or buying me a coffee, no to someone opening up a door for me, it really cut off the ability for me to be in this shared experience, to be in relationship, and for others to be in the practice of generosity. So this remembering of humanity, this remembering of generosity stands up to capitalism and patriarchy and all other forms of separation that we experience in our lives. And instead, it invites us to see how we can continue to open up and to lean on each other. When I began my practice, I wasn't expecting to find this greater sense of belonging. I didn't connect the sense of warmth and ease of body and the kindness of folks as an expression of this first parami of generosity. But these friendly gestures of allowing someone to lean on you, giving someone our undivided attention, attuning to another person's needs, this is all Dana. I just moved into our new home. We just bought a house about 6 weeks ago. And when we were making up the list of all the things that we wanted in our home, I also said, I want a really kind and generous neighbors neighbors that showed up and took care of us. And this morning, as I was thinking about this talk and putting some finishing touches, two strangers knocked on my front door and they said, "Hi, where are your neighbors from down the street?" And they actually brought this gift bag that has a plant and a book about West Philly and also baked goods, you know? It's this opening up of their hearts and saying, we're here. We're not tucked away in our little home. Like, we are part of a collective community and we want to let you know that we're here if there's anything that you need. And so once we incline our hearts towards Donna, we can't help but kind of be in the flow of this generosity all around us. And so this is from Sylvia Borstein, who is a dear teacher and friend of mine, an elder in the Insight lineage. She says that the Buddha taught that generosity was the first of the paramis because most people have something they can relinquish. She says that, in fact, they are easier to give up when I see that attachment to views constructs a sense of separate self and adds to my suffering. I think another manifestation of generosity is giving up destructive habits or lingering grudges. Sylvia goes on to say that in moments of clear seeing, which come through practice and perhaps by grace, we understand that anything we hold on to, whether material or emotional, is a potential source of complication and of our suffering. With that understanding, generosity becomes easy. And so the cultivation of generosity is about bringing people to mind, developing an intent to share. When we hold generosity as a value, we begin to get curious about the entirety of another person's life instead of this small and broken off or fragmented piece of their story. We begin to move away from pity and shame and towards deeper connection and deeper relationship. And similar to Donna or generosity is a sort of partner in crime, sila, the Pali word for morality or virtue. It also has a connection to empathy and connection to being in relationship with another and to being in an offering. But instead of the potential of a one-time thing, a one-time, offering of generosity, sila is making a full commitment to non-harming. So there is this staying power when we make this commitment. We say that no matter what, this is what I'm committing to. I left the church when I was about 11 or 12 due to racism and homophobia, which were not the values that I was learning at home. And I remember sitting my parents down as a kid and I was like, listen, I'm really in conflict. I'm hearing one thing at home and I'm hearing something totally different at church. And the adults can't seem to get it together. And so I'm just going to walk away from church until I can find something that makes sense for me. And my mom said that, you know, the only thing that I ask of you is that you treat others as you would have them treat you. And so she was asking me to enter into a social contract with every being that I would not only meet, but come in contact with, right? So even total strangers that I'm passing by on the street. So she was asking me to treat them the way that I'd want to be treated, whether they had decided that that was their value or not. That was the one that she really wanted me to hold. And so when I began to, when I began my practice in the Dharma, I was looking for a way to practice this principle. And thus, when I decided to take on this practice in my daily life, to always look for ways that I could care for other people. And so one of the lists that are so beautifully laid out in all of the lists of the Buddha's teachings are the five precepts. This promise to care for and protect others through not taking from being careful with our words, from being careful with our sexuality, and being careful with intoxicants that we bring into our bodies. And there is a tenderness when we realize that we belong to each other, when we realize that we are responsible for caring for another human, for our community. We begin to hold each other with such deep care and a deep fierceness. I first heard the precepts in the classical form. I undertook the precepts to not kill, to not steal, to not use divisive language, to not use my sexuality to harm others, to not use intoxicants. And, you know, I heard this on like that first night of retreat. And for me, all I heard was no. Don't do this. Don't do that. No, 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 no. And which is very aligned with, you know, the negative bias world that we live in. And so I was really curious, if this is what I'm supposed to not do, what is it that I'm supposed to do? How am I supposed to live this practice in my everyday life? How do I make these precepts active and engaged in the world that I'm living in? And my dear friend, Joanna Hardy, shared this version with me, which begins with knowing how deeply our lives are intertwined. I undertake the practice too. And this reminded me that I'm not just doing this for me, but for the ripple effect of how each thought, each word, each action can impact others, both known and unknown. So this is the form that I like to share and that we'll be working with as we explore sila or morality. So knowing how deeply our lives are intertwined, I undertake the precept to protect life. And so this looks like taking a pause of our habits, how we move through the world, how we are shopping, how we are consuming. Are we endangering the world by using more fossil fuels, by having things sent to us from across the world instead of shopping locally, as an example? So how can we protect life? And the second precept, knowing how deeply our lives are intertwined, I undertake the precept to be generous. And so when I first heard the precept to not steal, I'm like, cool, I don't have to steal. That's not a problem for me. But when I was asked to be generous, that's a whole different conversation. That's a whole different way of moving through the world. And so how can we be generous during this time of global fragility? How can we be generous in, you know, what can we share with others? I even think about the small things that maybe you've asked your kids to play in another room, or your partner to go hang out with their parents, like what my partner is doing today, so I could have this sacred space to be in practice. And so again, when we begin to bring generosity as a value, we can begin to notice the generosity of the blue sky or the generosity of a rainy day that allows us to stay home and tend to organizing our lives. And so the third precept is knowing how deeply our lives are intertwined. I undertake the precept to protect the sexuality of myself and others. And I don't think that there is an accident that the precept around sexuality is sandwiched in between the precept of generosity and the precept of speech. So for those of us that are queer or who might have, who might live a sexual life outside of the heteronormative lens, this can lead to a lot of misunderstanding and shame when we're being told to care for our sexuality. You know, for those of us whose sexual life might look a little bit different from what is considered to be, let's just say heteronormative, you know? And so what I'm hearing in this precept and in its placement is that there needs to be communication. There needs to be honesty. There needs to be a deep listening and a generosity of an open heart. When our partners say, this is what I need, this is what I don't want in my life. And so there's something about deep communication and generosity that allows this particular precept around caring for sexuality to be alive and to be something that is activated so we can really work on this in real time. The fourth precept is knowing how deeply our lives are intertwined. I undertake the precept to be careful with my speech. And this is a great time to practice those tenets of right speech. Is this true? Is it kind? Is it useful? Is it timely? Is this speech uniting people? Or is it divisive? And does it lead to fear and delusion and harm? The speech is also not limited to the speech that comes out of our mouth to other people, but also that internal voice that tells us that we're not good enough, that we don't deserve, enter whatever it is that we think that we don't deserve, right? So it's that deep listening and caring for not only our external speech, but also the internal voice that we hear that can really lead to a lot of our limiting beliefs. And then lastly, knowing how deeply our lives are intertwined, I undertake the precept to be free of intoxicants for a clear mind and heart. And so this is asking us to care for anything that denies our ability to be in direct experience with our hearts and our minds. Anything that gets in the way of our direct experience with humanity. So anything that blocks the felt sense of that quivering of the heart that reminds us about compassion, right? That quivering of the heart and that move towards sharing an experience with another person. And so intoxicants, of course, for some of us, that looks like drugs and alcohol. For others, that can look like hate speech that comes through social media, that comes from the news media, that comes from forms of entertainment like television and movies. There are so many destructive stereotypes that are played out over and over again. And so how do we protect the mind and heart from being intoxicated by those views of hatred? And so building a life on top of generosity and sila allows us to see more clearly and to have more discernment. Having a solid foundation of how we can live a life free of blame and harm can lead to a sense of freedom and liberation in our lives. allowing us to live with a heart and mind that is free from these three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion. So, dear ones, thank you for your kind attention and listening. I'm going to pause here for a few minutes because just to acknowledge that there's a lot of different learning styles in the room, including my ADD, which just sort of pings me all over the place. And so I'm going to pause and give us a few moments for reflection, a few moments to absorb the words that I just offered, to feel into the felt sense of how some words might have landed for you, how they might have opened the heart or flipped the belly, brought that clearing to the heart. I'm curious how these words landed for you and what's there for you to explore, to learn more about, to be in process with. And I also feel like the Dharma talk is never really complete until we bring our collective voices into this space of wisdom democracy, which my dear friend Bonnie Duran shared that expression with me. A chance for us to bring what we've learned, what we've experienced, what we've been practicing with into the space. And so I'm going to give us about 5 minutes to be in reflection. During this time, you can journal, you can move the body if that's how you process information. You can do a walking practice to allow it again to move through the body. You can sit in contemplation and stillness. And I'll offer you a few prompts if that's useful. And so just a prompt is, how do you know that generosity or these precepts of protecting life, how do you know when they are present? And how do you know when they are absent? So how do you know when generosity or any of these practices of protecting life, how do you know when they're present? And how do you know when they're absent? What supports you in that knowing, in the cultivation of these qualities? So I'm going to put these inquiries into the chat. Again, you can journal or just have them living in your body. And we will come back in 5 minutes, which will be 4 after the next hour, to be exact. And those reflections are in the chat for those of you who need to see them in writing. So have a great time of reflection, and I'll see you at 4 after the hour. And so we're taking about another 30 seconds or so to come back if you have been walking or journaling or in contemplation around this. And so I want to apologize to all of our dear friends on behalf of the strange American weird thing of changing the time zones. I'm seeing that some people are joining in at different times. So welcome to Victoria. Hi, Victoria. Welcome. And so I want to open up the floor to complete the question, to complete our talk today, and I offered a few prompts. So again, if you want to come on screen, that is my most favorite thing, and we can engage in conversation with each other. Or if you have a comment or question that you want me to respond to, you can also go under the Ask a Question at the bottom of your screen. And that is where you can add your question for me to respond to. And with this platform, there is also the option of sort of voting the questions up. And so if someone else has asked the same question that you have, instead of asking again, you can just vote on it. And so that question can be moved to the top. And so I can make sure that I can get that. And Faith is offering a little prompt around coming on screen, and she can invite you in. And I want to speak to somebody has said that they studied with Bhante Gunaratna, and the way that he offered the eight precepts, that the rest of them had to do with speech, which I'm actually really curious about, to hear three more around speech. The classic eight precepts, so the first five are taken by lay people, and the last three of the eight precepts include not eating past the zenith, which means that these are the last three are typically reserved for monastics. And so one of them means that monastics don't eat past the sun being at high noon. Another one is about not adorning the body with jewelry and makeup and fragrances, just not adorning the body. And the eighth precept is around, which is my favorite one, not sitting or resting on high and lofty furniture. So literally, like, not sitting in like a fancy chair or sleeping in a high bed. So those are the other eight of the precepts. And so I want to see if there are any questions that people have. Again, you can ask in that little questions and answer square on the bottom of the screen, or you can ask Faith through Sangha Live to come on screen so we can engage in conversation with each other. And also, I just want to again reframe that this is Wisdom Democracy, so also an opportunity for you to share what you've learned around your practice with working with generosity, the difficulties of being with generosity. And what has it been like for you to explore these precepts, especially when you see so much harm in the world? You know, there might be questions about how do we continue to live these precepts off the cushion, especially in the state of the world that we're living in. So Victoria would love to come on and be in conversation. Ah, yeah. And so Marita is saying about the precepts that that Bhante offered, that he might have adjusted them for lay people. And absolutely, I think that we need all the help that we can get. And so I really appreciate when teachers, especially, you know, a monastic, say, you know, and we understand this is hard, let's help some lay people out. So thank you. All right, so Victoria, I think you'll be coming on any moment. And as we're waiting on Victoria, I'll go ahead and read the question. So a lot of people are really curious about how can we balance being generous with the demands of other people seem to make upon it, especially with time. It can almost seem as if the more generous you are, the more people want to take or expect, which seems to be very tiring. Absolutely. And, you know, clear boundaries has been such a huge part of my practice. And clear boundaries does not mean that we're cruel, that we push people away, that we're mean. Clear boundaries is being really clear with our speech. Again, going back to the precepts, being really clear with our speech. You know, this is what I can offer you. No, I'm so sorry, I can't give you any more. So being really clear, and I think that when we really frame it through that lens of the precepts, like this is one of the ways that I am protecting life and protecting, you know, my energy and my heart is to only be able to give what I can give. It lands differently in the body when we can reframe it through the lens of the paramis, of the precepts. And so I hope that's really useful. So another person wrote, for me, generosity is supported. Okay. Things are popping around. Okay. What does it mean to be generous in relationship with people who seek to do us harm? Thinking specifically about anti-trans legislation, et cetera. You know, in that one, again, I want to make sure that remember that being generous does not mean that we are allowing behavior, that we're saying that your behavior is fine. What it means that we are being generous and expanding our heart, remembering that some people don't quite understand the harm that they are creating for other people. Being generous with people that are creating harm and legislation and creating wars means that I'm not going to allow my heart to be colonized by greed, hatred, and delusion, but I'm going to be generous and understanding that you are living with delusion, that there is some ignorance. And when I find that when I give some generosity around that, it allows me not to hate other people. And that's the main thing here, is when we begin to hate other people, when we begin to shut down our capacity to be in shared humanity, then that's when we're unable to be in our practice. And so being generous doesn't mean, again, that we are saying we love your legislation, but it means I'm not going to hate you. And I'm going to be generous in how I can be in conversation with you. I'm going to expand my heart and I'm going to see if I can be in relationship and conversation with you so we can somehow find that middle way, that shared humanity. And there's a lot that's happening. Okay, we are back in the question. So I'm wondering if the person who wanted to come on screen is able to at this point.
It wasn't possible so far, Booker. Okay. So yeah.
I'll just keep reading the questions that are in the chat then. Thanks, Faith. So for me, generosity is supported by connection both to the people one wishes to be generous with and a wider community that values generosity. So locked into my screen and social media, I feel that I have lost a great deal of that and I'm seeking to rebuild it. As a neurodiverse type who doesn't always know how to connect with others, is quite a challenge. Absolutely, you know, and this is why I love that we have not just this one practice, but we have the rest of them. I think of the whole of the Dharma as well as the 10 paramis and every other list in the Dharma. We don't just practice generosity. we look at what are the other qualities of heart and mind? What are the other aspects of the Dharma that we can bring in to support us? We don't just practice generosity alone. Generosity has to be supported by speech, by metta, by equanimity, by, you know, all these other teachings. And so I appreciate you saying that as a neurodiverse person, you know, sometimes we have to find a back door to get into generosity. I know for me, I couldn't go directly into metta. I had to go, or loving kindness. I had to go in through the back door of compassion in order to find metta. And so I just want to like expand our view that we're not just talking about this one thing. It's the expansiveness. It's the whole family of the Dharma that can really support a deeper knowing and understanding of these practices. So I am just starting to learn what it is to have boundaries in place after giving too much in the past. How, like Michelle said, do we balance that? And we find that when we are giving, 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 we wake up one day and realize that there's nothing left. And so it is so important for us to drink as we pour, to continue to nourish ourselves, to find even deeper rest, more space for rest, more space for joy, more space for play, the more that we are in service to others. I shared practice with vulnerable populations for 12 years in New York City, 10 of those years working with incarcerated youth. And I didn't understand about my own self-care, my own self-preservation, until I wound up in the hospital a few times, having to get blood transfusions, having to have reproductive surgeries. And so much of that was so rooted in my body being so depleted, and also not being to listen deeply to a body that was like, we need you to take care of us. My body was screaming for me to pay attention, to rest, to care for it. And I couldn't hear because I was so busy giving, giving, giving. And so I had to learn the hard way that sometimes when we continue to give, we deplete ourselves and there's nothing left. And so dropping back into that first foundation of mindfulness, knowing, you know, the felt sense of the body and how the breath responds, allows us to know when we are giving too much for our body, for our nervous system, for our neurodiversiveness, you know, for all of that. We begin to know ourselves in this more intimate way. And it begins for us to understand when we pause and say, that's too much. And to drink as we pour.
Hey, Booker, there are some questions at the top with some extra
questions. Thank you. So just seeing them come in. So how can we, so the first one we've already went through is another one. Okay. When dealing with ongoing disease that affects my energy level and emotions, how can I practice generosity with others? It is hard to continuously accept others' generosity when I don't have a lot of energy to give back. And so I also want to remind us and go back to, so first of all, thank you for that question for all of you that are like, yeah, let's talk about living with illness, living with disease, and that practice of generosity. So I've lived with a lot of illness in my life. I've had multiple surgeries, and most recently I suffered a concussion, which I didn't know that concussions, how horrible and completely debilitating they can be for your life. So I was completely unable to really function or work for over a month. And even now, my concussion was in October, and even now, 5 months later, I noticed I still have a lot of impact from my concussion. including energy level, including the inability to be in bright rooms for that long, including not being able to be a lot of like around like loud sound. And it can be hard to accept the generosity of others when you feel like they're just taking care of you over and over again. And I wanted to remind you that generosity is reciprocal, right? That when people are being generous to you and caring for you, they get to practice dana. They get to practice generosity. If you say to them, I'm good, I don't need your help, I got this, they don't get to practice generosity. And it's so important also to, you know, I know my community and my friends, and I know if they don't have it to offer, they wouldn't offer. So that could be another thing just to make sure, like, I so appreciate you caring for me. I just want to make sure that this generosity that you're offering is because you have it to give, right? Just to make sure that the person who is being generous isn't depleting themselves and offer in order to be generous to you. So that's one way that we can make sure that we are in a really loving and reciprocal and also equitable place of generosity, you know, to make sure that they have it to give. And I remember when I had my first surgery, my mom came to stay with me. I was very lucky that my mom was able to come in and take care of me for a while. And she was like, this is like the greatest gift, you know? She's like, when, you know, I raise you and I take care of you and then you're an adult and I don't know how to step in and care for an adult child. And so it was such an honor for her. And it was such a gift for her to be able to figure out how to care for me as an adult. And it's not about giving back. This isn't like a tit for tat, right? It isn't about making sure that you got me this time, I'll get you next time. You know, it's not about that. And when you have the generosity, I mean, when you have the energy to give back, you'll do it in your own way and you'll know what that is. And so I just want to, again, expand a review around what that looks like, what that can feel like. And maybe you and your friends, your community, you really engage in conversation so that it's really clear what that looks like for your specific group of your community. Because it looks different for all of us. Can you explain in a little more detail how to suitably follow the precept of speech? Should it also move beyond verbalizing something harmful, but even being able to not have harmful thoughts? Speech is broad. It is such a massive practice. And if you only practice speech for the rest of your life, you'd have so much to work with. And so, you know, there are the tenets of speech is, is it true? Is it kind? Is it timely? Is it useful? So sometimes things can be true, but they're not kind. Sometimes things can be useful, but it's not the right time to say it, right? Maybe somebody is triggered already. They are feeling very vulnerable. So it might not be the right time to drop that like pearl of like wisdom that you got for them. It can actually create a lot more harm for them. And so looking at those tenets are a really beautiful way to check in with yourself before you speak, to notice if there's this bubbling up and this like, I need to tell them that. Like, is that coming from ego? Is that coming from, I want to shame them? Is it coming from, I want to call them out instead of calling them up or calling them in towards our hearts, right? So looking at the energy that, underneath the need to speak, what is that about? Are you wanting to be right about something? Are you afraid that no one else is going to say it, and so you jump in to say it before anyone else can say it? Especially if you are one of dominant culture in a room, maybe take a pause, you know, do a little progressive stack and see if there is someone who is of a less dominant identity, whether that's through race or gender or ability, and maybe giving some space for their voices to be heard first before you jump in. So taking that sacred pause before speech is huge, and it allows for so much to be known before we can engage in speech. And the rest of that was to also move beyond verbalizing something harmful, being able to not have harmful thoughts. And I think that thoughts, speech, actions are all connected, because whatever we are thinking absolutely impacts what we say and how we move through the world and how we treat other people, whether it's conscious or unconscious. And so absolutely bringing in thoughts are definitely a part of the precept around speech. Thank you for bringing that in. So I noticed the experience of generosity is, I almost want to say, like, this is a lot of my own voice. And so I'm happy that the chat is engaged and open, but I'm just also just noticing how I'm like, it's a lot of me talking today. But I noticed the experience of generosity is pleasant. And when related to it with receptivity and appreciation, whether received or given, it seems to increase the pleasant. So they're saying that experiencing generosity is pleasant. And when they bring in people being either themselves or other people being able to be receptive to it and also offering appreciating it, it makes it a little bit sweeter. So thank you so much for that. How do you balance fighting for justice when people have done extreme and long-term harm, and what is right for the good of the wider public, and the natural, without feeling, natural anger, and at times a lot of dislike, even hate at times? I know that hate is not helpful, and I am someone used to feeling hate, as I am not generally hateful, but unfortunately with trauma, a byproduct and natural. So if you are new to sitting with me, anger and rage are my most favorite emotions ever. And I think that even feeling hate at times is a really useful quality. It is not useful to live in our anger, to live in our rage, to live in our heart, in our hate. It is not useful to respond or to react to the world through our anger, through our rage, through our hatred. What I know about these strong emotions, especially when we are looking at dictators, people who are creating legislation of hate and harm and destruction, I know that when I feel these strong emotions, that is a catalyst for me. That is, again, going back to that first foundation of mindfulness, I'm feeling how I'm experiencing it in my body. So I'm feeling the fire of rage, the fire of hate, and I'm recognizing that as fire element. And fire element can either burn me up and leave me as just like ash on the earth, or I can use that fire energy towards catalyst, towards change, towards my activism, towards writing, towards protesting, towards gathering people around, right? And so I don't want any of us to ever think that when we feel those strong emotions that they are not Buddhist, that they are not part of our practice, that they are something to push away. Absolutely. We actually bring them closer and we pay attention to what is it they are trying to show us. What is it that they want us to pay attention to? Where do they want us to incline our hearts towards? Okay. Yeah, so these next two questions are on equanimity. How do we bring in equanimity, and how do we bring in a sense of, you know, kindness towards people who've created great harms in our lives? The biggest thing that we can do, the biggest way to get back at people, is to not allow their harm, their hatred, to penetrate our hearts, to set up shop and colonize and take up space in our hearts. That is the best way that we can combat that. And there's a lot more to say about that when we are at our time. We are at the end of our time. I will say that I'll be speaking about a lot more of this in detail in my upcoming course with Sangha Live on the Pyrenees, where we're going to be really focusing on equanimity and metta, resolve, and patience. That's where the focus is going to be in that course, which begins the end of May. And I also want to come back to generosity again, which is that first parami, that first teaching that the Buddha ever taught. And he really believed that if people could not understand generosity, they couldn't understand the rest of the Dharma. And so it is that first teaching in the paramis. It is the foundation of our practice. And as many of you know, Sangha Live and the teachers who teach here really rely on the generosity of you, of our community, to continue on this 2,600-year-old practice that has not been broken since the time of the Buddha. And as one who lived exclusively off of the generosity of humans for many years, through my years of training, again, what a beautiful practice, what a beautiful way to live. It just allowed me how deeply people wanted the Dharma to continue and to grow. And through their generosity in offering me money to continue to pay my rent, to continue to travel and to study and to practice, It just allowed me to see how that Dharma wheel continued, how this generosity allowed us to stay connected to each other and allow the Dharma to continue. And so whatever you are able to offer, we would really appreciate, both Sangha Live and myself will be splitting the dana that comes in through your generosity. And I believe there is a button that you can click somewhere on the screen to offer whatever is available to you. Thank you all so much for sharing practice with me today. I sign up for my newsletter so we can stay connected. Also, come practice with me in May. I would love to spend 4 weeks with you really unpacking some more of these paramis. Thank you, Sangha Live. Thank you, Faith, so much for holding it down today. Thank you so much, everyone, and I'll see you soon. Be well.